13-22-29-CV, Frank Allgreen III and the Copernican LLC versus Frank Allgreen and Elise Leek and co-trustees of Allgreen Management Trust.
May it please the court. There have been lots of briefs filed in this case, even through this morning, that focus on the very colorful events from 1997 through about 2001. And I'm going to get into some of that in my argument. But I'd like to start today in a different place on the timeline. That's late 2019. I think it's important to take a moment to really look at what is the structure of the plaintiff's claim today and how it works, because that will affect how the other issues in the case fit together, and it will show the court why we think we have some paths for the court to rule about all the claims at once. Their argument is that in late 2019, Nim Allgreen, who's the father, was the actual owner of some specific asset such that he had a right to demand their return to him. There's sort of two chains of ownership that are at issue. The simplest one is they claim that Nim Allgreen was the actual owner of a house at 4602 Rosedale that had been purchased in 2008 and titled to Paco, his son, and only to Paco, his son. There's no notation on that deed that Nim has any ownership. There's no writing about it. The claim is that Nim owns that property despite the deed because of an oral conversation in 1997, about a decade before the property was purchased. The other chain of ownership that's invoked by the plaintiffs also goes through a piece of real property. That's 4410 Burnett Road, which was purchased in 2006, also titled only to Paco. And it was actually sold in 2015. The argument being made by the plaintiffs is that on the theory that Nim was the actual owner of the property, he's the owner of all the profits and proceeds from the property and can enforce the benefit of the bargain of that ownership, and that's the chain that gets you to the current house in Park City and to the Bitcoin.
And are you saying that he's not the owner because his name is not on the deed?
That is one of the reasons. So as I've outlined these two chains of title, I think this really should set off every alarm bell in Texas law about protecting property titles, protecting the integrity of deeds and the certainty.
Well, I understand that his deed is not on the name and wasn't on the name of either properties, but I don't think that we can look at the ownership of either of those properties without looking how the ownership was obtained by Paco, the son. So the question then, it's almost like when you're trying to follow either community or separate property in a marital estate. How do we follow the chain of income to purchase the Rosedale and the Burnett Road? And don't we have to take then the 1997 conversation into account?
Well, I think procedurally the court will have to take it into account because of the summary judgment ruling that's made it complicated for us to raise limitations as our lead issue. But I want to point out something important in this case, which is part of the plaintiff saying their actual claim is only about 2019. Their pleading disavows getting any remedy for any breach prior to 2019. In their live pleading, I think the record page is 1603 to 04, this lawsuit does not seek to bring claims against defendants for any of Paco's breaches of fiduciary duties prior to Paco's refusal to return Nim's share of the assets of the proceeds in 2019. So it's possible for a plaintiff to show up in the situation that these plaintiffs found themselves in, to confront limitations, to confront those issues and say, we're gonna sue about a breach in 2004. We're gonna sue about a breach in 2001. We're gonna try to find an exception to limitations. We're gonna try to
remedy. So are you saying that the breach as to, let's for example say it's the Rosedale home, and I think that was purchased in 2006 if I remember correctly.
I think that was 2000, there were two Rosedale homes.
Okay.
I think that was 2008, yes.
Okay, 2008, you're right, there's two Rosedale homes. So are you saying that if a breach occurred of any kind of fiduciary duty occurred in 2008 when the Rosedale home occurred, and as such, the statute of limitations has run to the Rosedale, and you can assess now a 2019 breach of contract?
I think that's what the state of the law is. And okay. One of the cases we brought to the court in a letter on Friday was Villarreal versus Villarreal, which is also a case with two children of an elderly parent where a number of years had passed, and the court found that limitations did bar a claim that a prior deed had been barred by fraud because it had been recorded in the property records that party was on notice. But we have a procedural wrinkle here, which is that we can't squarely raise limitations that way because of the no evidence motion. We think it is essentially conclusively established on this record that in light of Berry versus Berry and the Marcus and Millichamp case just from this January, that this record would be conclusive. But because there was a no evidence summary judgment against our limitations defense, we're in sort of a weaker position to make
that. Well, then shouldn't there have been a charge question as to when the breach occurred? I mean, when I went this morning and while I was re-preparing, I went straight back to the charge because that's where we should end and start this case. And there is no date on the charge as to when the breach occurred.
Well, I believe it's conclusive all the deeds are there. But we were not in a position to ask for that. First of all, I'm not sure it's our burden to have asked for the discovery rule question. But the court had made very clear there was
If you're seeking it as an affirmative defense, don't you have then the burden under Castell to ask for the breach of date on your contract?
The court had already ruled against us on no evidence summary judgment. There were a couple of times in the trial where these questions started to come up, and there were objections from the plaintiff's side. The court said we're not trying these things by consent. So we were in a position where we weren't able to put in all of our evidence. You know, if we had a limitations defense, we would want to be putting evidence in about all the about things happening in the past. And we were not in a position because
I understand you didn't waive it. Was there a question requested from the court, which is what I could not ascertain, as to a breach, a date of where the breach occurred?
There was not, Your Honor. So I think I'm going to go out of order what I planned. But
I usually do that to people. That's okay, Mr.
I hope
Bruce.
So. I hope it's responsive to where the court's interest is. But the other sort of red flag that should set off about property law is the statute of frauds. And the theory, the plaintiffs had a half dozen theories that they pleaded, and they would bounce, as you would expect, they'd bounce back and forth as they were challenged. They chose to try a theory of oral trust. That's what question 3 says, question 4 says, question 5, question 6, oral trust. That's what they put on. And we moved for a judgment as a matter of law that and Texas law does not enforce an oral trust in real property. So we think that in this unusual situation, there's a basis for rendition on the basis
of statute. But at the time that they're stating that the oral trust is created, it wasn't real property. It was an account that started as Tennessee and then became a Schwab account. So at least to the extent that I understood the flow of the money, it wasn't that the trust was created from real property. It wasn't that he converted. He then took money and converted it into real estate. So I'm not sure that the statute frauds occurs at the time that the conversion occurs, if you understand my question.
I understand very well. They cited no cases that adopted that view of the law. The statute itself seems to say the opposite. Okay. It says a trust is enforceable only if there's a writing.
And what part of the statute are you looking at, Mr. Cruz?
The first sentence applies to all trusts in real or personal property. Okay. And it may be worth talking about there the second sentence, which applies when there is a trust consisting of personal property, is what it says. And what these two sentences do is they provide a plaintiff with two different ways they could try to satisfy the statute of frauds. Right? It doesn't impose a burden on us. All we have to do is point out they're enforcing a trust. That's our only burden. We did that. That's why the summary judgment on this was improper. But for a trust in real property, our reading of the trust code and the whole reason this is in the trust code is that if you're trying to enforce a trust against real property, you need to have some documentation to protect the interests of third parties, third party creditors, others who depend on the chain of title. As I understand the plaintiff's argument, if there was a trust created with a single dollar sometime before a trust bought real property, it would just be exempt from the statute of frauds. No one else in the chain of title would ever need to know that there had been a trust. And we think that completely subverts the purpose of having a trust code statute of frauds, why the legislature adopted it in 1943, why it's still a featured part of the statute. And it's very clear You know, they may say, we need to know when we create the trust. It's very clear, if you're going to add real property to a trust, everybody knows real property takes paperwork. You need a signed writing. And if you're going to add real property into a trust and bind that real property title with a trust, you have to meet the statute of frauds.
But if they use that that money from the accounts, the Schwab account or the other account, and use it to purchase, but don't tell the purported, or in this case, the junior, Mr. Allegren Jr.,
yes,
that you did that, then are you saying that that's the date of the breach of the fruit? If he in fact did that, then there was something going on. He did it, but that was the date that you should have gotten the statute of limitations charge on that.
Our reading is that the date of the breach would be the date of the deed being filed. If you think about it as a fiduciary claim, then you would ask when it was discoverable and reasonable diligence should have been discovered or actually discovered by the person. There's some case law that's discussed a little bit in the Villarreal case that it's not even clear that's a rebuttable presumption when there's a deed that's been filed. But in this record, we know that Nim knew about the property titles. He testified he knew. He said it bothered him, and he didn't do anything for limitations purposes. I mean, our view is for statute of frauds purposes, he's now barred from proving up and enforcing that ownership interest because he doesn't have a writing as well.
Let's assume for the record that you're correct, that you were indicating that there was a breach that occurred in 2006, 2008, 2015. Does that in any way invalidate a subsequent breach that could occur in 2019? In other words, you don't have to have one breach of the fiduciary duty. You can have several. And in this case, the plaintiff, as is her right, has claimed only the breach after 2019 when they've asked for the trust to be terminated and for the assets to be returned. So what does it matter that they were previous breach if they can prove the 2019 breach?
Because the question is when the legal injury occurs, and that's when his name comes off the property.
Well, there's a legal entry according to the appellees here that they were at that time asking for their assets to be returned, and that's the breach that did not occur. Whatever he did with the money beforehand is irrelevant. He had money that was given to him. I think it was 1.3, which is where the inheritance started in that Schwab account, or whatever money was played, and now he wants that money back. Why is that not a valid cause of action, regardless of what he did with the money or whatever breaches he may or may have not occurred in the interim? I understand that he's now converted it into real property, but even if he hadn't converted it into real property, there still could be another breach in 2019, as alleged by the plaintiffs in this case.
But it can't recover for the same legal injury that's already barred by time. And again, the Villarreal case is a very simple fact pattern, but it's instructive about this. If that daughter working with her mother against the other daughter had come in and said, let's make a demand. We're going to demand that our other daughter give us back the full title, and you're going to say, listen, you're my daughter, you owe me a duty as my daughter. That doesn't restart limitations. It's not a distinct
I'm not
breach.
Talking about restarting limitations. I fully understand, and I understand the Villarreal case because it was one action. What we have here is, do we have a separate independent breach that occurs in 29, regardless of the breaches that occur then, that then created another harm? Not the harm that he converted money that he wasn't supposed to convert or whatever, whether he did or did not do anything in 2006. He now has another breach. There's another breach that occurred in 2019 that has an independent damages.
Well, I think this is an example where if there really was a trust that still existed until 2019, you could still get certain kinds of remedies against the trustee. Like you could change who the trustee was. You might say, hey, we need an accounting and actually get an accounting, which they didn't put in their proposed judgment here. But you can't use that premise of getting equitable relief to reopen things that are closed by limitations. I'd really like to discuss why there wasn't a trust here, and I know I've used my time on other things. I'll try to do it as quickly as I can.
That's okay.
Tell me. So their claim at trial as to how they owned this property was that there was an oral trust. You know, I think there's an agreement between the two sides that it's not about the magic words. It's not about whether he used the word trust or didn't use the word trust. Because Paco was never accused of being a trustee until this lawsuit was filed. And it's, of course, possible for lawyers to come in later and think up a new legal theory to describe facts that the parties hadn't intended. But in this case, the question is, what was the real substance of the relationship that Paco and Nim are said to have talked about in 1997? And that bears on the elements of creating an oral express trust. And this Chapman case that we point to, which is the idea the court cannot impose a trust where the parties have contemplated another relationship. And here, they're talking about giving financial advice, helping manage Nim's assets in place while they stay in Nim's name. They're talking about a power of attorney, not a trustee. A power of attorney means you have a written document that you show to someone to show you have authority to act on assets that are titled to the principal, right? It's inconsistent even with the idea that there really was a trust. And when we—
Okay,
we,
so let's assume, let's take the word trust out of it. And I know we're over time, so just bear with me, Ms. Mills. He was something, whether you want to call him a trustee or something, mm-hmm. but he held with him some type of, I'm trying not to use the word trust, some type of relationship between father and son of which he was managing his father's money and owed him some sort of duty.
I think that's true. There's okay. a power of attorney through Schwab. And there's some scope of fiduciary duty associated with the power of attorney.
So would you agree with me that he owed a duty to his father to manage the funds in a non-negligible way?
I think a power of attorney's duty is scoped to the power of attorney, and they didn't really prove up what the terms of it were here. But all we know, what we actually do know from the record is that it did not give power. It did not give Paco the power to transfer assets out. It gave him the power to trade on the account, but not to transfer out. Nim testified that his own signature was required for transfers. He could write checks. So he had some limited scope. And so there's some duty. And he had some duty in the early 2000s. And I think that's really incontrovertible.
So what duty did he have then, if he didn't? And just to finish this up, and I'll give you your full 5 minutes at the end. What duty then did he have, if not, which is question number three of the charge, I believe it's three, I'm bringing it up. No, it's not three. Call it trust or not, but that he breached the, there it is. You never can find it once I need it. I guess it is three. I mean, they call it an oral trust, but they call the trust, a trust is a special relationship that arises when the settlor shows an intent to create a relationship that requires one person to hold property for the benefit of another. So did he not have that relationship with his father?
Absolutely.
And was
not.
It not the jury?
Absolutely.
You don't believe
not.
that because the facts that set out in this case hold that there's a special relationship
the two things I point out. The first is we moved for directed verdict before that question was submitted on the basis of
that.
An oral trust. I think that's the PJC language about holding property. But holding property means holding legal title to the property. That's what the case law says is the key. You have the basic hallmark of a trust. What gives it that special superpower is the legal title has to actually be put in the name of the trustee. That's why they don't need to be a power of attorney. That's why they have such onerous duties. And this record is extremely clear. Nim did not transfer or authorize the transfer of these assets into Paco's name, and Nim did not intend it. And as you got through getting past the word trust and kind of giving him a chance to really explain in our cross-examination, that came through again and again. He did not contemplate this relationship as one where Paco would have the assets in Paco's own name. And that's why this is not a relationship that was an express trust. It was something else in the early 2000s, but it was not an express trust that lasted to 2019.
Okay.
I apologize for taking a little more time, Your Honor.
That's okay. That's why we're here, and this is why the case was set for oral argument. Thank you. Anything further from?
No.
Okay.
May it please the court. I am proud here today to be representing Nim Algren before this court, and I urge the court to affirm the judgment in all things because it is well supported by the evidence and by the proper application of Texas law. And though the judgment is substantial, the remedies in the judgment are based on the jury's verdict, and they are appropriate to regress Nim Algren's egregious breaches of fiduciary duty and maltreatment of his elderly father. Now, Paco has raised many, many, many issues on appeal, and our time today is short. And so I've prepared a booklet of oral argument exhibits that you should have there on the bench. That it's a booklet with tabs, and each tab has an outline of one issue, not all the different issues raised, but some of the of kind of the big threshold issues. And I also included the final judgment and the charge. And I hope that this can be helpful today in discussing whatever issues it is that the court would like to discuss. And this may also be a handy guide for the court to take back because it points to cites to some evidence and case law and an outline of the arguments when the court sits down to write the opinion. And there are three tabs in here that I hope I'm going to be able to have the opportunity to discuss with the court today. And based on the questioning that's already occurred so far, the first one I'd like to talk about is tab number one. This is an extraordinarily important conceptual notion in this appeal. And that is, you're exactly right, Justice Benavides, this is not limited to an express oral trust. We tried this case on two distinct, independent legal theories. Yeah. One
let
is.
Let me ask you this. And we talked at length earlier with Mr. Cruz about the express oral trust, and so we did not touch on the informal trust. And the way I read it, that either way, you win.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you go that route. But don't the two conflict with one another?
No,
saying
Your Honor.
On the one hand you have an express oral trust, and on the other hand say it was an informal trust?
Well, Your Honor, it's no, they are not consistent with each other in any way, and here's why. What they both boil down to are different ways under Texas law to impose a fiduciary duty. Fiduciary duties can arise in a lot of different contexts. One can be an express trust, whether oral or written, if it complies with the requirements, the express statutory requirements under the Texas Trust Code. Another way that we have pled here, we proved, and we secured jury findings on it, questions number 8 and 9, is an informal fiduciary duty, sometimes called a relationship of trust and confidence. And there is nothing inconsistent about it. The conduct that can qualify under the Trust Code can also be conduct that qualifies under an informal fiduciary duty.
So they're not mutually exclusive.
They are not mutually exclusive. They are 100% independent. They spring from different sources. An express trust springs from the Trust Code, and it has its specific requirements, and in a minute I'm going to talk about why those are met here. The informal fiduciary duty, or relationship of trust and confidence. So you see, Justice Benavides, that word trust appears in both instances. A relationship of trust and confidence and informal fiduciary duty gives rise to fiduciary duties and can support all of the same remedies, except for the attorney's fees award, as an express trust does. And the fact that the word trust appears in both is of no moment. But the source of the informal fiduciary duty doctrine is common law. That the Texas Supreme Court recognized it in 1980 in the Moore case. It's discussed a bunch in the briefing. And the Moore case, the facts there are exactly like ours. It was a family relationship. There was an elderly aunt whose nephew was helping take care of her, took over taking care of her business affairs, used her bank account, paid her bills, and then the question was, well, after she passed, did he own all of these things, or was he in a fiduciary capacity where really those assets were hers. And the court said because of that, the confidence, the special confidence reposed, it gave rise to this fiduciary relationship, and the nephew had the burden to prove that the transactions between them were fair. And so we had those findings. Questions 8 and 9 in the charge exactly track the common law. And so
if this court was to find that, in theory, if we were to find that there was no express oral trust, but still found that there was an informal trust, the only thing that would be excluded then would be attorney's fees, is that right?
Correct. You could just line item that out, render judgment on the whole entire rest of the judgment, and let us go along our way. You do not need to unravel anything else in the judgment. Now, that is an important, the distinction between the two, that each of those are independent causes of action, independent legal theories, and we're entitled to judgment the greatest relief that we can get. That's why the judgments were based on express trust, because we have the extra line item of the attorney's fees. But independent support the same remedies except for attorney's fees. And then what I'd like to do is skip forward a little bit to tab number 6. This is the second of the three things I want to be sure I talk about. And that tab number 6 talks about the summary judgment on statute of frauds and limitations. Let's talk about statute of frauds first.
Can we talk about statute of limitations first?
We'll talk about limitations first, Your Honor. Statute of limitations...
Only because that's where my head is.
Yes, Your Honor. And I have a bunch of things to say about statute of limitations. One is that there is not a question in the charge asking specifically about when did this occur, but a lot of the questions in the charge ask cabin the jury's answer to October 2019. They ask the jury about an event in 2019. Did Paco breach his fiduciary duty when he didn't give the assets back to NIM in October 2019? Did he fail to comply with his duties in October of 2019? So the jury charge asks the jury about the conduct in October of 2019, and that is significant in a couple of ways. One is, Mr. Cruz talks about, oh, we pled this and we pled that in our pleading. A summary judgment was granted on limitations, but proof is in the pudding, in the jury charge, that each and every question that we asked was cabined to the specific conduct of not giving back the assets in 2019. That is the only breach that we sued for.
But you sued in question, specifically in question number, let me get to it. Again, I never can find it. Where you have each of the individual assets.
Well, Your Honor, the...
So you ask them specifically about each of the assets, and what Mr. Cruz is indicating as the breach of those did not occur in 2019 because those assets were obtained much sooner than that.
Whether they were obtained sooner than that?
Or at least the breach occurred when they were obtained.
There may or may not have been a breach when it occurred, but that is not the breach that we are suing for. And that is the difference between this case and the Villarreal case. In the Villarreal case, the allegation was the deed back then was fraudulent and I'm moving to set it aside. We're not trying to set aside any deed. Paco could have had the real property in his name. That's fine. Okay, a little weird, but whatever. We're not suing for that. That is not the basis of our lawsuit. And that's the question for this court. Not whether some conduct might have been barred by limitations, but whether these causes of action were barred by limitations, and the answer is no.
Let's stop there for just a minute, Ms. Weber. If the lands were purchased, let's just, for the sake of argument, with Mr. Nim's number in 2006, 2009, 2014, 15, whatever year you want to pick before, and that's when the breach occurred, why are we then having a discussion about them? That breach occurred. And if that breach occurred, the statute of limitations has run on those breaches. Why are we discussing them in 2019 in question number 1?
Because that's not when a breach occurred. The fact that Paco purchased a piece of property in 2006 and put it in his name is not a breach of any duty for which we seek redress in this lawsuit. If Paco kept that in his name That's no problem.
But once he transferred the money and it's in his name and the property's in his name, it's not like in the Varial case that we can hold a, you know, that's the problem. We can't change the property record deeds of any of these properties.
That's true, Your Honor, and we're not asking the. Here's what we've asked for.
I think the question is,
go ahead.
Is that if you establish that there's an oral trust and the trustee then converts money into a real property and puts it in his name and not the trust, is that a breach?
That may or may not be a breach, but it's not a breach we are suing for today. In fact, what we wanted Paco to do was invest and manage NIM's money for NIM's benefit. And Paco was exercising his best financial judgment. He, you know, I'm gonna sell this stock and buy this piece of commercial property. Oh, look, we made some money on it. I'm gonna sell that commercial property and buy these two other pieces of rent property. I'm gonna sell that, I'm gonna buy some Bitcoin. What he's doing there, there's no breach in him taking stock and buying real property. That is management of NIM's money. That's what their agreement was. You're going to take this, you're going to manage it. You're going to deploy it for this investment or that investment. The breach occurred when NIM said in October of 2019, okay, I would like my share now so I can go and live in retirement with my daughter. And Paco said, get out of here, I don't owe you anything. Now, as far as real property records are concerned, yes, there is a, if, for example, Paco had sold one of those pieces of property to a third party, and we could not have gotten that back, that third party would have been a bona fide purchaser and would wind up with that piece of property. We would have a potentially a claim against Paco for dollars, but we lose the protection of that having Paco Algren as trustee for NIM Algren would have in the real property records. We're not suing for that. What we're suing for is after all of the time of the investments, I buy this, I sell that, I invest here, fine. Okay, now give me my share. Get out of here, I owe you nothing. That is the sole breach. Well, and there is nothing in the-
saying, what you're saying then is that with regards to real property, then he could have given the property back through another deed. I mean, that's one way to get it done, if you ask for it. And the deed was in someone else's name.
Correct. And that's the relief that we have gotten through some of the post-judgment orders is in the constructive trust, we are given a 50% interest in the two pieces of real property that are subject to the constructive trust. And Paco has been ordered in some post-judgment orders to give us deeds conveying us our 50% of those two pieces of property. And the 50% comes from the jury's answers to question one and question two of whose money went into it and in what proportion. The jury found 50-50, and so hence the 50%. If I may, I'd like to address real quickly the statute of frauds question. And I guess I have two layers of, well, the reason I want to mention this, Justice Bennie, you look like you're trying to ask me a question.
No, this is the issue that I care about. I want to
hear the statute of frauds. Okay. Yes. All right. I really want to talk about the statute of frauds issue today because I think that this issue on appeal best illustrates how completely divorced Paco's arguments are from the record, from the law, and from the proper consequences of Paco's conduct. Because there are a bunch of instances, statute of frauds being one of them, where Paco deploys here's a technical thing that's wrong. Here's a technical thing that's wrong, so I get to keep the money. And in many instances, the technical thing is he's incorrect, and even if you were correct, you don't get to keep the money. Let me track through the statute of frauds and show you how that works. So the statute of frauds under tab 6, I've got the language of the statute there. And mind you, this statute of frauds, 112.004, this is applicable only to the express trust cause of action. This is not applicable to the informal fiduciary duty theory of liability. So the statute says a trust in either real or personal property is enforceable only if there's written. And then the second sentence says, has an exception. A trust consisting of personal property is enforceable if created by a transfer of trust property to a trustee who is neither blah, blah, blah. So the statute of frauds treats creation, if it has real property, different from creation as personal property. And the PJC reflects that same construct. The PJC reflects the exception that creating a trust with just personal property, which was the case here, it was only stocks and that sort of thing, mutual funds. The PJC reflects that exception. I've cited it there, 235.2, the comment says, you may create it in personal property without a written document. Under PACO's construct, validly created trust with just personal property in it, the trustee can unilaterally, I think, you know, under cloak of darkness, like you said, without informing anybody, but the trustee can unilaterally take that personal property, in this case, the funds in the Schwab account, purchase real property, ha-ha, statute of frauds, it's not enforceable, you get nothing. I get to keep it all. PACO gets everything, NIM gets nothing. And that is wrong on the two levels I said before. First, he's wrong. He is wrong that statute of fraud applies here. There is no authority that says that you can do that you can wash out the interest of the beneficiary through a unilateral act like that of the trustee. But more important, Texas courts have recognized that trustees might engage in this kind of misconduct, and they have accounted for that by saying, but you can have a constructive trust. That a constructive trust is not barred. It is accepted from the statute of frauds, because we're not trying to enforce a trust here, Justice DeHittina. What we're trying to do is get redress for the breach of fiduciary duty by a trustee. And the ton of case law we've cited for you there that fiduciaries don't get to retain it. The ha-ha, I get to keep the money. No, you can't do this. And that same fallacy of does PACO get to keep the money, because here's a technical thing, appears in a bunch of different issues that are raised on appeal. One is, for example, the Park City House. In the opening brief, oh, you can't get a constructive trust on the Park City House because I put it in Copernican's name, and Copernican doesn't owe you a fiduciary duty, only PACO does. Ha ha, I get to keep it. Well, no, because Copernican is your alter ego. The jury made a finding of alter ego, and so we disregard that. So there are a bunch of instances in the issues presented to this court that are, ha ha, technical issue, I get to keep it, and neither level is correct. The technical is not correct, and the he doesn't get to keep it, the remedy is incorrect, and that's a fallacy that appears throughout. Now, I want to turn real quick back to tab number 2 to address the question of the creation. And mind you, this is only if the court is going to be going forward on the path of the express trust. Whether or not we've created an express trust, is all of this is not applicable if what the court does is affirm on the basis of the informal fiduciary duty, questions 8 and 9. But I've put out here the statutory provisions. There are two ways, prong 1 and prong 2, to create an express trust. Prong 1, I've given you a bunch of sites to where PACO has expressed, I'm doing this stuff for NIM's benefit. I've got NIM's assets and I'm investing it for NIM's benefit. I'm looking out for NIM's stuff for NIM's benefit. And if you turn the page, prong 2, NIM intended to create a trust and he transferred control of his assets to PACO. And what Mr. Cruz told you is that could not have happened. Could not have happened because these things were not in PACO's name. The accounts were not in PACO's name. And that is wrong. And the Texas Supreme Court case of Perfect Union that is cited in both sides' briefs, Perfect Union perfectly illustrates this issue. PACO's opening brief quoted that that the separation of legal and equitable estates in the trust property is the basic hallmark of the trust entity. And that's the quote. But the very, very, very next sentence in the perfect union case says, technical words of expression, however, are not essential for the creation of a trust. It is not absolutely necessary that legal title be granted to the trustee in specific terms. And so I pointed out that language in my brief of appellee, and Paco's response in the reply brief was, oh, well, that's a testamentary trust, and that's different. It's a testamentary trust. But I've cited case law here that shows that perfect union and this rule is cited both in the context of inter vivos trusts and in the context of testamentary trust. The rule for creation of trust is the same, and the rule provides that technical words of expression are not required. So the bright line that Mr. Cruz pointed out is simply not applicable. And before I finish up, I know I'm on the court's good graces right now, but I want to make one last point, and that is the issue that's behind tab number 7. This panel might not be aware of some of the other history involving this case. So there have been two other proceedings in the 13th Court relating to this merits dispute we're arguing about today. Right at about a year ago, there was as collateral to the merits, there was a dispute about supersedious. We had a briefing on it, and there was a memorandum opinion that did two things. One is it said that Paco could supersede the money judgment part by posting costs, which he did, but that if he wanted to supersede the constructive trust portion of the judgment, he would need to post a supersedious bond of $45 million, which he never did. So then, meanwhile, we're back in Travis County District Court, and there's a whole series of proceedings back in Travis County District Court, post-judgment proceedings, because Paco again and again and again will not comply with lawful post-judgment discovery, will not comply with court orders. And there was a round of orders to compel and turn over your electronics, and he totally disregarded those. So then there was another round of a sanctions order and a show cause order with a contempt hearing set and an order regarding the conveyance of make the deeds over to us for 50% of the constructive trust assets. That was briefed, that got transferred, that was a mandamus.
That's the mandamus.
That was the mandamus, and it got transferred to the 13th Court, and it was assigned to the same panel as the supersedious dispute, which is, doesn't overlap with the three of you. There was a temporary stay put in place in July while we briefed the mandamus. It's now fully briefed, and so the stays are still in place. So since July of 2022, Paco has essentially had the benefit of supersedious of the constructive trust without posting a dime, notwithstanding that this court previously ordered that to get that benefit he would need to post a supersedious bond of $45 million. And I don't know exactly what this panel can do about that, but I thought that it was very important that this court be aware, because this case is an absolute justice delayed is justice denied circumstance. My client is 89 years old.
Your time is up, and I just want you to rest assured that we were aware of the memo supersedious bond, and we are aware of the sanction mandate is still proceeding. Do you have anything else on the underlying case?
No, Your Honor, I'd want to make one tiny point that if you are going to, what you have before you, every single finding necessary to render a judgment. If you think there's anything wrong with the judgment that Judge Amy Clark Meacham signed, then we urge you to render and not remand anything. You can render, and then Mr. Cruz can take up anything on rehearing if he thinks any of it is wrong, according to the Boyce Ironworks case.
All right, anything further? All right. Mr. Cruz, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I want to start with the perfect union case about trust formation. I think the two sides agree that you have to look at the substance of the relationship, not magic words. We're just reading perfect union differently. Perfect union is a probate case. In that case, the question was, did the party's will sufficiently specify the testator's intent to transfer assets such that the court could then step in and actually make the transfer that created the trust. The court understood and repeated and has the key quote in Texas jurisprudence that the legal and equitable titles have to be split. That's what the intent is about. What that court said was you don't, that if, and if you look at the language of the will, in that case, it talks about appointing a trustee and that trustee having power. It just didn't have that little sentence in the middle. And the court said that is clear enough indication of an intent to transfer actual legal title that we, the court, are going to do it. There's nothing like that here. Here we have Nim testifying he did not transfer, did not authorize a transfer. He had no intention these assets go in Paco's name. There was some relationship in the early 2000s. The plaintiffs did not bring a claim for breach in the early 2000s. They did not ask the jury about breach in the early 2000s.
So is your stand that all the assets are Paco's and Paco's alone?
Of the ones they've challenged here, yes. Okay. Because they all trace through these two pieces of real property.
And so that they, irrelevant they, for where the money comes from, it's all Paco's now.
They forced this choice on the court. Okay. We recognize there's a rhetorical pressure. Surely there's some remedy out there. They made a strategic choice not to sue for any breach before 2019. And that relates to this informal fiduciary duty point, which is the second thing I want to cover. It's not true that that's just a substitute for the trust. Informal fiduciary duty existing in a family does not create a property interest. Being a father and son who were close.
But you do agree that there is a common law duty on a breach of duty.
There can be.
Okay.
Yeah.
Whether they're related or not related,
absolutely. But all of the remedies here are traced through the assertion that this was NIM's property, returning NIM's share of the assets. That's the breach question and the remedy question they actually asked about informal fiduciary duty. And their theory seems to be that there is no limitation period for fiduciary breach. That as long as you come back later and say, well, it turns out you're a fiduciary of mine, we have an informal relationship, give me the assets, give me the things back that happened 10 years ago, 20 years ago. You know, there's just no limit to their.
I don't know if they're asking it for back. What they're asking for is whatever assets they had originally and whatever money profit has been made. I didn't see anything in the judgment that they're asking, as at least in the. They did not ask the jury to give the property back or to assess the property back to Mr. Neem. They're just saying.
I think that's what a constructive trust does. Is it? It gets filed in the property records, and it's a judicial indication that someone actually is the equitable owner, notwithstanding what the deed says, in addition to the post-judgment orders they've been getting. But I want to point out, they did not ask the district court, and the district court did not award disgorgement, the $29.3 million for informal fiduciary duty. That was awarded in this judgment only for express trust. There's nothing in this judgment to affirm about that for informal fiduciary duty, so that would also go away. Turning very quickly to limitations, there are a lot of cases in the law where you have the same two names on both sides of the V. A lot of those are trust cases. A lot of those are cases about informal fiduciary duty. They involve family relationships that go back many years. We've brought you a couple that apply the statute of frauds, that apply the statute of limitations. They're all throughout our briefs. These principles have to also apply in family situations because limitations and the statute of frauds also protect the expectations of third parties. And these are important principles we have in the law. So they keep saying they're not trying to set aside the deeds or change the substance of what happened or get ownership back. But that's addressing these cases too, where you can't try to get an equitable remedy to essentially get back assets or money that was lost years ago. You can't just recharacterize that as being about some ongoing duty. It has to be timely brought. And this case is a wonderful example why, because we don't have any documents from the first 10 years. NIM didn't keep the statements that were mailed to him. So we can't even fully defend ourselves. And that's part of what limitations is supposed to protect us and the courts from having to decide. Thank you.
Anything further? All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate, the 13th Court appreciates sitting at the Third Court of Appeals. And unless we have anything further, we stand adjourned. This case will be under submission.